The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie LeConte.
Joining us this week on Polling Politics is political journalist Martha Gill. Hello.
Hello.
Martha is a former lobby correspondent who's written for, among others, The Guardian, Huffington Post, The Economist and The Telegraph. This week, there's really only one thing to talk about. Geordie Shore star Vicky Pattinson is said to be in a, quote, heartbroken mess and, quote, feels like crumbling after fiancé John Noble was pictured cozying up to model Poppy Owen at a nightclub in Dubai on Sunday.
Is this a weird extended Brexit metaphor?
We're going to have to talk about Brexit, aren't we?
Fine.
If for no other reason than I have no idea who Vicky Pattinson is. I just copied that down for a joke. So here we are. The Brexit deal has been published, and what fun it's caused. The main points are that there's going to be a transition arrangement until at least 2020, during which time all EU regulatory, budgetary, supervisory, judiciary and enforcement instruments and structures, that's a hell of a sentence, will continue to apply within the UK, including rulings made by the Court of Justice. There'll be no hard border in Northern Ireland and all sorts of controversial backstops around that. The City of London will be granted a level of EU market access similar to that granted to the US and Japanese firms. There'll be protection for the 3 million EU citizens in the UK. Good news, Marie.
Woo!
And over 1 million UK nationals in EU countries will be able to continue to live and work there. There'll be no visa requirements for travelling around, and freedom of movement will be maintained until a final agreement is reached. Oh, and the UK will honour all existing financial contributions, estimated to be worth around $50 billion. So it's gone down, well, in a mixed way. As we record this, Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab and Work and Pensions Secretary Esther McVeigh have both resigned from the Cabinet, along with junior ministers Shailesh Vara and Suella Braverman. What's going to happen, Marie?
Well, I can say with absolute certainty that I have no idea what is going to happen. My instinct would be to say that Theresa May is not going to go. I think she is going to survive this. But also, I've been wrong about many things recently, so who knows?
The next stage is that this is set to be signed off by the European Union on the 25th of November, and then we'll have 2 weeks of debate in the Commons after that and a vote preliminary penciled in for December the 7th. Martha, you studied neuroscience and philosophy at Magdalen College, Oxford.
Oh, okay, what's that got to do with it?
How does that relate to the sort of general mental deterioration and nervous breakdown that this country is suffering over Brexit?
I quite enjoy my course. I'm quite enjoying the breakdown from the safe distance of being outside Westminster.
More importantly, will the government get this through the Commons?
So I think we were just saying before the podcast started, this all comes down to Labour, what Labour will do, because at the moment what May's dealing with is the high possibility that Brexiteers, sort of the 80 or so members of the ERG who are very strongly idealistically committed to a hard Brexit, which her deal isn't showing, along with the DUP, will probably vote against this deal. And she might be able to get all the sort of moderate people in the middle on her side and Remainers, but then it depends what Labour will do.
The latest polling from Delta Poll shows just how divided the country is on this. The two most popular options are that Brexit should be abandoned altogether and that we should refuse to make any more concessions to the EU and leave without a Brexit deal if necessary. There's not really much support. I mean, admittedly, none of these gets a massive amount of support. You get 26% of people wanting to abandon and 22% of people wanting to go no deal.
Actually, I thought the really interesting thing from yesterday is that May actually raised a third option rather than her deal or no deal, which is or no Brexit at all, which is the first, I think that's kind of the first time that she's acknowledged that there's that massive sort of people's vote campaign and a lot of people who don't want Brexit to happen. And so that must be quite encouraging for people who want a second referendum, right?
But isn't it as well, I think it's quite interesting in terms of like the dynamics within the Conservative Party, where for a long time it was basically my deal or no deal. And so we kind of knew that, you know, number 10 was basically more worried about the Remainers because they were like, actually, you know, if you vote against us, like you'll get an even worse thing than, you know, like what you want.
That's a really good point.
And now actually the fact that that's now shifted to actually, you know, it could be, you know, so my deal or no Brexit at all, that means that the threat has now moved to the ERG. So it's like, well, so I'm not sure how, if you can really play that threat on both sides. And
no, you can't. You absolutely can't, because everyone sees the option that they want is now on the table, or the option closest to what they want is on the table. And so they might be encouraged to rebel.
But then I think, again, coming back to the Labour MPs, it is quite interesting because, yeah, like if you have all those three on the table, like what do you do? Like genuinely, I'm so glad I'm not currently a Labour MP, because I do think that what do you do? It is such a massive gamble.
Yeah, exactly. And there's sort of several ideological and practical positions that you can take, and they're not all the same ones. So you could be a Labour MP, as many of them are pro Remain and want a second referendum and think that's the best thing for the country, in which case you would vote against. Or you could be a Labour MP who really wants an election and is just kind of cynically doing whatever it is which will help engineer that, in which case you would vote against. Or you could be a Labour MP who is sort of pragmatically thinking that this is okay and that you really don't want a risk of a no deal, which you think would be bad for the country, in which case you'd vote for. And it's really difficult to, you can sort of work out who the MPs are in each of those camps, that you don't know which one they'll be voting.
It's of course the case that the first vote could be on December the 7th, and then we could have subsequent votes in order to allow people to vote against the first thing and then gain some massive stroke, completely irrelevant concession that then allows them with a heavy heart to support the government. Already commentators like Tim Montgomery have come out and said this is not a great deal, but it's effectively the best that we can get, and so he would reluctantly support it. Not that he's an MP, but I imagine that's kind of representative of some of the Conservative MPs. But really, it all comes down to Labour, doesn't it?
I think it does in terms of the numbers, which is why, yeah, I have no idea what you were to do, like what you'd do as a Labour MP right now, honestly. Because also, I think, especially for the MPs in kind of like quite Brexity northern heartland seats, like, what do you do? Because I think, you know, the kind of like, you know, pro-Corbyn MPs and kind of, you know, faction in general really want to vote against the deal. And so I think that anyone who would vote for the deal might get deselected or might lose, you know, whatever tiny slither influence they have at the moment. But equally, if you vote against the deal in, again, one of those like proper Brexity heartlands, are you sure you can actually keep that seat at the next election anyways? It's an intense calculation to make.
Yeah, that's true, because if you think about the number, the percentage of the country who will actually like this deal, it's going to be quite small, isn't it? It's going to be very small, and there's going to be so much more political capital to gain as an MP who voted against it, and to sort of say, well, I didn't stand for this, and now look what's happened, whichever side of the argument you're on.
In public opinion terms, it's the nightmare scenario for May, which is you come up with something that a huge number of people think goes too far, a huge number of people think doesn't go far enough, and you're stuck in the middle with a halfway house that, rather than pleasing all of the people all of the time, fails to please any of the people any of the time. And how you reconcile that with your party's support is a real challenge.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that now Remainers are starting to blame May as well, because the argument was always, oh, Brexit was a terrible idea and so we should remain. But as when Joe Johnson resigned, he said, well, May has messed it up and that's why we should remain. And I thought that was kind of an interesting shift in their argument, and it kind of allows more people to come onto his side, really, who can sort of with some dignity say, well, I thought Brexit was a good idea, but because she messed it up, we should remain.
Maybe we'll have Boris Johnson going up against Joe Johnson for leadership of the Conservative Party.
That would be excellent.
I mean,
brothers
fighting for leadership works so well for Labour. I think it would be a real winner for the Tories.
But that being said, and that might be out of date by the time this podcast gets out, but
yes,
that's
a caveat we have to announce. If the Prime Minister does resign at any stage, Nick, the producer, has promised to let us know.
But I do think, you know, like, yes, a kind of time of recording, all the resignations we've had so far, like, I have read all the letters. I am yet to see one person who objects to the current deal and actually explains in a level of detail what deal they would like to see instead, and a deal that is feasible. None of them has put forward, like, put anything forward, because I think that on the more sort of like soft Brexit side, you could argue for, let's actually stay in the single market and customs union. You could say let's have another vote, or let's just stay in altogether. On the Brexity side, I am yet to see one proper option that could work, that the EU would take, and that would not put the Good Friday Agreement in peril.
Yeah, that's very true. And what a lot of people are saying at the moment, what the sort of narrative now is that the split is no longer between Remain and Leave, it's between pragmatists and idealists. And you're seeing that particularly on the right of the party, who don't really have a pragmatic solution. They just want to make their feelings known.
But also, I think, you know, I do have some sympathy, a level of sympathy for the argument of saying, you know, this is actually not what people voted for, you know, it's not a great deal. I completely agree, it's not a great deal. But then who you should be angry at is not Theresa May, I think, or Number 10 or Ollie Robbins or whoever, is the people who made the Brexit campaign to start with. Like, the Leave campaign made promises that were completely, you know, that were never going to come true. So I think that's the bottom line for me. I love that, actually, for once. But actually, like, it's normally in this podcast quite hard to talk over you, Joe. And like, this is the one where you're just not saying anything. You're just like,
just
he's just
very
banging
depressed.
His head on the table.
It's all a bit depressing, really, isn't it, that we find ourselves here. But
it's depressing and exciting.
Yes, excitingly depressing or depressingly exciting. Find ourselves here, we do. What chance do we think then for a second referendum? Do you think the publication of this deal increases or decreases the chance of a second referendum?
I think the deal itself is the one that most likely to mollify people who want a second referendum, because, you know, it's got loads of things that people who objected to Brexit in the first place might like. It's quite good for businesses. A lot of them were coming out this morning saying that it was quite good. The fact that there are no quotas, no tariffs, there's a sort of sliding scale of regulation, that there's a possible extension, the cliff edge is gone. So a lot of people who are worried about the horrible effect that Brexit might have on the economy they're feeling slightly okay about it. But the sort of logistics of the reaction might propel us closer to a second referendum, because of all the people resigning, because of the fact that the deal might not get through, and so therefore we'll be left in a situation where the Commons are perhaps voting for like a no deal or a second referendum as a result. And I think it's probably quite likely that a lot of MPs will sort of think, can I put my name to a no deal? No, let's go for a second referendum. And by the way, a key point is also that the EU, of course, are likely, if they see that a second referendum is coming, they're going to extend the time that we have to do that. It's not the case that we'll be bounced necessarily into a no deal. If we tell them that we want a second referendum, they'll be like, okay, have more time.
I think the problem here is also that actually I don't see why you'd support a second referendum unless basically what you wanted was Remain. Like, I think there's no other position, mm-hmm. because actually, you know, there's not going to be, I think, a deal that's, you know, a lot better or even really a bit better than like the current one. And no deal will just remain bad, whatever happens. And so I think that I can definitely see the people who think Brexit is a mistake and saying, actually, you know, we think the public might have changed their mind. So, you know, let's kind of like put it to a vote again. I can sort of see that. But yeah. Anyone who's not actually a Remainer, I don't really see politically what would change with a second referendum.
And also, I suppose it would be very unwise, a lot of people feel, to initiate a second referendum when you think Leave might win. Because if Leave win a second referendum, then we're going to be in a potentially worse situation than we are now, at least in the view of pragmatists and Remainers. Because what it will do is it will make a lot of people very angry in the country. They'll be galvanised, the far right will possibly be galvanised. All the people, the hardest Brexiteers, will be pushed up to the top of the party. It will probably become painfully clear what people on the Leave side actually want, which I suspect will be very hard to then renegotiate, if renegotiation is indeed possible. So yeah, I think that is a massive risk, and lots of people are aware of that. So that is the thing that might prevent a second referendum.
Europe has described this deal as a lose-lose situation. and it certainly seems to, from a political point of view, Theresa May seems to be in difficulty over this. Can she survive, though?
I don't know. Part of me still thinks that she will survive this, because I think the ERG, by the way, they're having a meeting in like literally a second, I think about 10 minutes after we stop recording. So cannot wait to find out how out of date we're going to be by the time this comes out. But yeah, again, I think they have the numbers to basically trigger a no confidence vote. I don't think they can win it.
Mm.
Like, because also, again, like, there's no obvious person. I mean, the name that's kind of being put forward a bit at the moment is Michael Gove. Of people saying, actually, you know, Gove is someone who people in the Conservative Party would trust on Brexit, but who people who are more, you know, kind of soft-Brexity, Remain-y, might go for. But I'm not really seeing it. I generally think she will survive. And also, I don't think she will go. Like, I don't think she is the sort of prime minister who will eventually crack. I think she'll just actually... She is weirdly resilient. I think that's the one thing we found about Theresa May over the past year. She is weirdly resilient.
Gove seems to be happy, at least for the time being, to bide his time, to adopt a wait-and-see policy.
Mm. I agree with Marie, and I would add to that that we're in a... It's not just May who's resilient. We're like in a weird period of politics where the normal rules... to apply, obviously. And so, you know, if people, the sort of things which would propel someone out of their post a couple of years ago no longer seem to have that effect. And now we're seeing that right across politics. So it's sort of like this sort of post-shame, where it is, era where sort of you can be humiliated or lots of people can be against you. You can be told to go and you just don't do it. And somehow that's fine.
And of course, she might survive some more cabinet resignations. As we sit here at the moment, mm-hmm. no one more has resigned, but we could see Penny Mordaunt go. Maybe we should record some possible scenarios. Well, Marie, so Penny Mordaunt resigned. My goodness, Martha, Michael Gove going. That's got to be a disaster, hasn't it?
I cannot believe Penny Mordaunt just fucking set fire to the green benches and then just ran out. Just cannot believe those scenes. Incredible.
I can't believe Michael Gove literally stabbed several people in the back.
Yeah, exactly. Moving from the metaphorical to the actual stabbing in the back would indeed be a huge
development. Grabbed the mace and then waved it around.
All of these things might add. The weird thing is, with the exception of the stabbing, or even including the stabbing, none of this would actually be particularly strange given the weirdness of the situation. But on a more serious point, Esther McVeigh resigning. Marie, you were saying that that's now the sixth work and pensions secretary in the last 3 years?
It is, and which is incredible. So I was looking at the list earlier. Martha, I'm going to ask you a question. Just, I'm going to preface it by saying that I could not, like, this is something I could not do, but I'm kind of trying to prove a point in general here, but can you name the last six DWP secretaries we've had in the past 3 years? Because there were two I had straight up forgotten about.
I don't want to display my lack of knowledge here, so I'm not going to reply, and also...
what do politicians not... always answer on the Today programme?
I'm not going to give a running commentary on the number of...
I'm not going to answer pub trivia questions.
Oh God, yes.
And I'm not going to answer because I don't know the answer.
The list is Ian Duncan Smith, Stephen Crabb, Damian Green, had entirely forgotten about him, David Gawk and Esther McVeigh.
Wow. Who next for...
Hang on, that's five. Oh, you know, we're about to get the sixth.
Yes, right. And on that question then, who do we think will replace Dominic Raab as Brexit Secretary? Who do you turn to if you're Theresa May?
Again, Gove, I think, is the name that's been bandied around. Mm-hmm. It might be wrong. I think the person people seem to be talking about, and also it is very funny, again, at time of recording, Rory Stewart has just been tweeting super nice stuff about Theresa May all morning, but just, you know, like, one step away from, like, and her hair looks so good. And like, you know,
if in doubt, Rory Stewart. Or Alan Mack.
Oh, yeah. Our future Prime Minister. Prison great again.
Future Prime Minister Alan Mack or... Comedy Rory Stewart or Michael Gove. It really is an exciting group to choose from. The DUP.
Boo.
Presumably as a party set up to shout no loudly, they are well placed to throw a spanner in the works. Do you think that they can bring down the government over this?
They're a key bit of the jigsaw puzzle against her, aren't they? It's just, you know, they're sort of a small group, aren't they, compared to like the numbers in the ERG
or Labour rebels
or even the number of Remainers in the Tory party.
We're joined now for our weekly chat with Sarbjit from Smarkets. Hello, Sarbjit.
Hi there, how are you doing?
I am good. And this week we have been discussing Brexit, which inevitably means that we're discussing the possibility of Theresa May's departure. There's not much of 2018 left, but the market seems to have moved a bit on that.
Yes, 2018 is climbing as we approach the end of it with all that's going on in Parliament at the moment. 2019 is declining as a result.
And is this her departure as Conservative leader or her departure as Prime Minister?
So it's leader of the Conservative Party.
Right, so she could still, of course, remain Prime Minister in a John Major type way. I can't wait for that excitement. And of course, inevitably with discussions about Brexit, there's also the question of who might or might not resign. Is this a big market for you?
Yes, we've got two markets on the next cabinet minister to go. One on which minister it will be, and then the second one on how many will go in the near future.
Do you have a market on the overall Brexit outcome? No deal, hard deal, soft Brexit, blind man's buff, that sort of thing.
We've got several markets concerning Brexit. I think we've got seven markets. We've started a new one around whether we'll have a general election first or another referendum on the EU.
Ah, and what comes out top?
General election, 60%, because the Labour Party's preferred option is a general election first, and if they can't get that, a people's vote. It's not to say that the Conservatives themselves won't trigger a referendum kind of call on a people's vote to try and settle their own differences as well.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so exciting. And of course, by exciting, I mean horribly, horribly terrifying. Moving over to the other place, we have what is quite frankly one of the weirdest idiosyncrasies of British politics coming up, the election of hereditary peers to sit in the chamber. Now, there aren't many people voting on this, and there's only a small number of candidates, but you've managed to come up with a book on this.
Yes, I think that this is interesting because we might actually have more people eligible to bet on this market than actually vote in this election, which will be the first time ever this has happened. Yep, we have 90 hereditary peers, well, 92 who are ex officio, so there's two ex officio, 90 who are elected, and the list of electors is given in statute. So we know actually the exact names of the electors, and we have a list of them. So if you think you know these people, or you are these people, you may have a good insight into who's going to be elected. It's fun to look at the statements that they have produced, explaining why you should vote for them. There's a number of them who've given their outside interest, where they like to spend their time, and which gardens. And then two who've...
Which gardens? Front garden, back garden? I guess it's different if you're a little lord.
Yes, exactly. And but there's even two who've not submitted anything at all. Just simply their names they put forward. They're on the list. They have the right to put their names on the list because of their pedigree, and they should be elected.
That's pretty old school, I mean, to just put your name. But I guess it is the House of Lords, so you would expect a certain degree of, we'll call it tradition, if we're being generous. Moving to the United States, we discussed in our special from Washington last week about the Attorney General and Jeff Sessions resigning. You have a market on who might replace him.
So yes, we have a market on who's going to be potentially the next Attorney General. We have two front runners. We've got Chris William Kobach leading on 24% and Alex Azar on 14%. Chris Kobach's ahead because he's got very hardline views on illegal immigration. And he supports stronger voter ID laws and a Muslim registry.
the Holy Trinity, as it's referred to by some Republicans.
Alex Azar, on the other hand, he's the United States Secretary of Health and Human Services. He used to work for Big Pharma and was a lobbyist for Big Pharma. He's a critic of Obamacare and he opposes abortion rights.
And what about Matt Whitaker, who's the acting Attorney General? Is he getting any love at the moment from the markets?
He's on the market, but he's not a front runner.
Oh, that's interesting. So people don't think that that Trump's choice will necessarily make it.
Yeah, he's another hardliner. He's someone who's definitely there for the interim role and with good reason. But it's clear that Trump would like to go for an even harder liner, if possible.
And certainly the scandals surrounding Matt Whitaker make him perhaps too toxic, even for Trump. But I guess we will see on that.
Well, I'm interested to know what makes something too toxic for Trump.
And on that note, Savjit, thank you very much. We'll speak to you next week.
Thank you.
How I'd love, love, love to dance with my father again.
And finally, Martha, your mum wrote a book.
Yeah, she did, yeah.
Tell
psychological
us about that.
Thriller. Very exciting. It's about a family.
Very exciting. Which is,
well, yeah. I mean, I couldn't read it because of the sex scenes in the early chapters. But I hear that it's very exciting. And it's done very well. It's called The Daughter. So, you know.
Available
so
from all good Amazons.
Indeed.
With that in mind, what percentage of the British public do you think believe their parents had a favourite child?
Yeah, I don't know. It's sort of belief and then confirmation out of belief. I mean, we all know, I'm one of five, and all of us know that my youngest brother is the favourite. It's always the youngest brother, I think, or maybe the youngest sister. So if you have a younger sister or a brother and you didn't know, they are the favourite. Just get over it.
So that it's interesting you should say that. So you would fall into the category of they probably did and it was not me. Although actually, in your case, it's they definitely did and it's not you. Marie, what do you think?
Did your parents have
a favourite?
So I'm definitely my grandmother's favourite grandchild.
I'm my grandmother's favourite as well, because I'm the oldest, but same. Also the best.
Same. Yeah, no, I know. There's literally,
that's a good point. Yeah, I think I was as well.
There's an amount of resentment among my cousins, which is very funny. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm guessing probably quite a high percentage. Like, let's say around 40% of people reckon that parents had a favourite child.
Well, 40% say they probably did not have did not have a favourite. You have 10% who said they did and it was me, 26% who say they did and it wasn't me, and then you have 12% of people who didn't know their parents or didn't have siblings, which doesn't help the stats, and 13% who don't know. But yeah, so 40% saying they didn't. That seems low to me. I think most parents, even if they don't say, have a favourite. But I would turn this around and say you could also have the situation where all children are equal except one who's definitely not the favourite. so in your family you have that one.
No, but I don't. I wasn't the least favourite. How dare you?
I genuinely got that bit wrong.
I think we should keep this bit in just so that everyone can see.
I completely agree. Oh my god, like, this is like, I'm sorry, bullying politics, not being mean to people, the podcast.
Usually it's only low-level bullying for this, and I am sorry about that. What I meant to say was, I think you could turn it around, but obviously that's not the case in yours because you have the one that you know who is the favourite. Or do you have a rank order?
Jesus Christ.
Okay. I think we're going to have to bring this to an end.
Oh, no. Oh, I was really enjoying it.
Martha,
thank you, and sorry.
Yeah, Martha, sorry about all of this. Thank you very much for coming in. Thanks. Martha's mum's book is available from Amazon if you want to read about the sex scenes that she refers to. Thank you to Subject Bakshi. This episode was sponsored by Smarkets. Thanks very much. We'll hopefully see you all next week, or we might all be eating grass by then. No time for our interview with Theresa May. She was busy, but there is time for just a quick look at the coverage from Downing Street. That's all. See you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.